for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez. Here's what we're looking at. City Council members moved to reject Mayor Johnson's plan to hike property taxes. One-on-one with outgoing Cook County State's Attorney Ken Fox on her last 8 years in office. And advocates are pushing back on the city's new shelter approach for migrants and unhoused residents. And now to some of today's top stories. Chicago's Board of Education is pressuring Acero Charter Network to keep open 7 schools it's planning to close. The 6-member board unanimously approved a measure today demanding Acero return any unspent public funding if it moves ahead with the closures. Acero leadership last month announced plans to cease operations at these 7 schools. Those closures would impact more than 2,000 students and around 270 educational staffers. And an update to a story we brought you back in June on 51-year-old Michael Broadway, who died while in the custody of the Illinois Department of Corrections. Broadway's family is now filing a wrongful death lawsuit against the department, accusing Stateville prison staff of ignoring his medical needs during an asthma attack that led to his death, according to an autopsy report. The family's attorneys say prison guards were aware he was struggling to breathe in his cell during excessively hot conditions and did not provide him with proper care. IDOC and Wexford Health Sources, the controversial private health care provider for IDOC, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Broadway earned his bachelor's degree from Northwestern University while serving his sentence. And City Colleges of Chicago is celebrating the expansion of Malcolm X's new campus on the city's west side today. Elected officials and college staff gathered to break ground on a new community center for teaching and learning on the college's west campus in the Austin neighborhood. The $17 million project is the second phase of City College's investment and is expected to include programs for healthcare roles and recreational spaces for students and the community. And attention, Chicago sports fans, there's a new way for you to watch your favorite games. The Chicago Sports Network announced today it's launching its subscription-based streaming service on Friday. The new platform will carry Blackhawks, Bulls, and White Sox games. Subscription packages will start at $19.99 a month for one team or $29.99 per month for all three teams' live games. And if you love tacos, you won't want to miss this. Mexico's first Michelin-star taqueria, El Calafe de León, has teamed up with Tocombe Wicker Park for a pop-up event. On Wednesday, they served 4 of their famous taco recipes, including thinly sliced beef tacos, homemade tortillas, and their legendary salsas. Missed out? Don't worry. 2 of the tacos are still available through November 28th at Tocombe locations in Wicker Park and Fulton Market. This small taco stand has been a staple in Mexico City since 1968, and they look really good. Now, up next, City Council members reject Mayor Johnson's plan to hike property taxes. Heather Sharon with more on that right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Mayor Brandon Johnson's plan to hike property taxes by $300 million is dead after a unanimous vote today by the Chicago City Council. That sends negotiations over the city's 2025 spending plan back to square one. Our Heather Sharon joins us now with more on this stunning rebuke of the mayor. There's a lot to talk about here, Heather. So the City Council voted 50-0 without debate to reject the hike of the property tax. First, what message does that send? And secondly, is that unusual?
It is unusual, especially the lack of debate. Politicians love to demand sort of accountability and rail against tax hikes. None of that today. This is also a deeply divided city council, and for them to get all on the same page tells you two things. This was a deeply unpopular proposal by the mayor, who, I should remind you, promised not to hike property taxes if elected mayor, and it shows that he didn't fight it. He knew that it was dead in the water, and he did not insist that his allies take an unpopular vote when he knows that, as you said, said they have to go back to the drawing board on the city's spending plan for 2025.
So does this mean property taxes won't have to jump to fill the city's budget gap?
That is very much up in the air. They will not jump $300 million, but it is likely that the city council will have no choice but to approve a property tax hike of some size, simply because the gap is so big and the city has just such a limited number of levers that it can pull to raise taxes. What you will see is sort of a larger amount of tax hikes, perhaps a bigger tax hike on alcohol, perhaps an increased garbage collection fee. Really, everything is up for grabs except for layoffs. Mayor Johnson says he will not accept a budget that lays off city employees or cuts city services.
So what happens now?
Well, it is going to be a tough 47 days for everybody at City Hall. The deadline is December 31st, and so the rubber is going to meet the road even as people try to celebrate Thanksgiving and Christmas with their family. This is a little bit of unprecedented territory for the city council. Last year's budget was approved November 15th, which is, of course, tomorrow. We are far away from that today.
Well, thank you, Heather, for that update.
Thanks, Joanna.
And you can read Heather's full story on her website. That's WTTW.com/news. Now to Brandis Freeman with an elected official about to leave office. Brandis.
After 8 years in office, Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox is passing the torch. Fox was among a cadre of so-called progressive prosecutors to take office around the country, promising to reshape the nation's criminal justice system. After Fox announced she would not seek a third term, voters chose retired Judge Eileen O'Neill Burke to take over the office, saying that she'll take a tougher on crime approach. Joining us is Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox. Kim Fox, welcome back.
Thank you, Brandon. It's good to be back.
So, when you look back on these last 8 years, how do you see that time? How is the Kim Fox of today different from the one who took office?
The Kim Fox of 8 years ago was wildly optimistic about the opportunity to transform our criminal justice system. And the older, wiser Kim Fox is really proud of the work that we've done over the course of the last 8 years. I didn't anticipate it would be as rocky a ride as it was, but I'm incredibly proud of what we've done.
You were, of course, a vocal supporter of eliminating cash bail, which has been in effect for over a year now under the Safety Act. What are your thoughts on how it's not only impacted public safety, but also the people who come in contact with the criminal justice system?
I mean, this is historic legislation. No other state in the country has eliminated cash bail. And a year out, a little more than a year out, we've seen that people who are not a threat to public safety are able to go home, work, provide for their families, and are still showing up to court. And that people who pose a danger are being detained. And so the impact is significant for those individual families and communities where the devastation of trying to find cash to secure their freedom is no longer a burden. And more importantly, we aren't seeing scenarios where people would be willing to plead to anything to get out of jail, to go home. And as we've worked on wrongful convictions, I think people miss there's a connection with the cash bail system, where people were languishing and saying and doing whatever they could to get home, and we've minimized that.
The legalization of cannabis and then expunging records of people with minor marijuana convictions in their past, it was another mission of your tenure, of course. Does Cook County need to go further with weed equity? What more do you think can be done?
You know, first of all, the fact that we legalized weed, again, first state to do it legislatively, and the vacating of those convictions, I have to remind people that African Americans and Latinos were 4 or 5 times more likely to be prosecuted for weed cases than white citizens. And so from an equity standpoint, legalization and allowing everyone to be treated the same was critically important. Where we are now is that we don't see those prosecutions for marijuana. But when you talk about going further, we still have, in terms of the business model, where people who are benefiting, profiting from legal marijuana sales are not reflective of the people who were harmed from the prosecutions in the past. And so I know that there's been work to try to make the business more equitable, but from a criminal justice standpoint, I'm proud to say that we are not prosecuting those cases.
Throughout your time in office, certainly when you were first elected, you, along with several other prosecuting attorneys around the country, were labeled as so-called sort of progressive prosecutors. But you've also taken some criticism from folks who feel that your office could have been tougher on crime and on prosecutions. How would you describe your approach to criminal justice?
Our approach was being smart on crime. I have to remind people that every day when they pick up a newspaper or watch the news and they say prosecutors have charged or prosecutors got a guilty verdict. That's Kim Fox's office. I tend to hear that my name is mentioned when there is something negative, then it's Kim Fox. But every day, our prosecutors are putting in the hard work of prosecuting gangs, guns, and drugs, prosecuting people who are committing violent offenses, prosecuting the murderers of Paul Bauer and Ella French and Hadiyah Pendleton and Tyshawn Lee. Those cases were happening. We can do both. And one of the reasons that we wanted to have data publicly available was so that you can compare. Were we prosecuting as many gun cases as my predecessor? And the reality was, not only were we prosecuting as much, but more. And so I think there was a perception issue, because we talk so much about reform, that people took for granted that the hardworking men and women of the state attorney's office were prosecuting cases at higher levels than most other prosecutors' offices in the country.
You've made it a priority for your office to review the integrity of some convictions to determine whether or not those convictions should still stand. Why did you take that on?
Because I knew that the reality was that these are human endeavors and the criminal justice system is fallible. And as a prosecutor, there's nothing that keeps me up at night more than thinking, did I put someone in prison for a crime they didn't commit? And Cook County had a reputation of being the false confession capital of the United States. We had a history with Commander John Burge that everyone is fully aware of, and others. And so I wanted to come in and say, listen, we owe a responsibility for people who don't trust the justice system to acknowledge when we've gotten things wrong and actively work to make them right.
As your time comes to an end, I know that you've been getting a lot of calls and requests from individuals who are either incarcerated or have a prosecution on their record, as well as their attorneys, for their cases to be reconsidered. Yeah. How much of that are you able to do before you leave office? And obviously, that time is coming quickly.
It's coming very quickly. And listen, we appreciate the urgency of the matter for those who believe that they've been wrongfully convicted. But we don't vacate a conviction in a blasé manner. It's real effort to review the file, talk to witnesses, look at history of cases, sometimes that are 10, 20, 30 years old. And so if those cases hadn't been in a pipeline for some time, it's almost impossible to get to them. And so it's certainly my hope that my successor will continue to take those calls, to have a unit that is aggressively looking at these cases, because I believe we've just scratched the tip of the iceberg.
State's Attorney General Kwame Raoul has launched his own conviction integrity unit in his office, just announcing that this week. Do you think something like that is necessary, a statewide office?
Absolutely. It's something that I'd been calling for the last couple of years. If we in Cook County have 250 convictions that we vacated thus far, I know that the human system that we have in Cook is the same one in DuPage or Alexander or Champaign County. I also know that we have a budget and resources, which still aren't nearly enough, given the volume, that those smaller counties don't have. And so in the interest of justice, I think having a statewide review is important. And I think it is very important that the Attorney General is taking a lead on that.
Then there's the Jussie Smollett case.
Yeah.
How do you look back on that? Would you have done anything differently? And how do you think that will, where does that fall in the legacy, the 8-year legacy of Kim Fox?
You know, I think the media will always connect Jussie and I together. And listen, I've always said that my biggest regret about that is the light that it's shown on our office that eclipsed the work that they do every single day. This was a low-level nonviolent offense, and it's still 5 years later being litigated before the Supreme Court. And while that case was pending, there were people who were trying rape cases, murder cases, significant cases. And so, you know, in the history of media attention to one case, I've never seen anything like it. What I certainly would hope is that we have that same level of scrutiny of what happened with Jussie in the cases of Jimmy Soto, who spent 42 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, or others. Or the fact that in that case, we had a special prosecutor who was appointed almost within months. And I think about the Kochman case, where the mother of this man who was killed took years to get justice. And so I think there is a conversation to be had. I'm grateful to be a part of the conversation, even if the spotlight was high, to talk about what is our priorities on justice in Cook County, where a celebrity accused of a nonviolent offense could garner that much ink. But these poor black and brown folks who have been released from prison don't get nearly the attention that they deserve.
You're the first black woman to serve as Cook County State's Attorney, only black woman to serve as anybody's state's attorney in the state of Illinois. What challenges do you face? What were the hardest parts that you went up against?
Listen, I think anytime you're breaking a glass ceiling, and it was indeed a glass ceiling, you get cuts. And so I have a lot of scalp wounds. There's a level of scrutiny that is very different when you come into this work as a first. People don't know what to expect. And so there are those challenges of having your credibility questioned, folks undermining your decisions. Processes being different than what your predecessors had seen. But I never worried about that. There was work to be done. And what I knew that as a Black woman doing this work and all of that attention that I would garner, that I had to have a level of excellence to deliver. And it's why I smile when we talk about we've eliminated cash bail, legalized marijuana, vacated hundreds of convictions, and have prosecuted people who've killed police officers and everyday citizens. I'm proud.
You've said that you experienced some threats, though, very real threats to yourself and your family.
Absolutely. I didn't talk about it in real time because the work matters. But the level of sexualized and racialized threats that I received, there was a man who, threatened to shoot me in the head and hang me from a tree and was prosecuted for that. There was a man who served 18 months in federal prison for threatening to rattle my brain with bullets. I think we have to talk about that in this era of this political climate where it now feels that anything goes. Public servants don't sign up for that. I'm a mother of four daughters, and I remember there were nights that I was afraid to walk outside of my home. And I certainly would hope for my successor that she would not have to see that as a woman doing this work, and that she would have people around her who would make sure that she's safe and protected.
You have been in touch with your successor, Eileen O'Neill Burke.
Yes.
Given her advice, I assume.
Certainly. Look, she is well-versed in the law. She has a significant amount of experience. It's very different being a lawyer and then being the top prosecutor. And so certainly, I've told everyone around her, the county board included, to give her grace. But for her, really to get engaged with the communities that she serves, get from behind the desk, get into community, and listen and have the humility to work together collaboratively.
And we're out of time, but everybody's going to want to know, what are you doing next?
This radical thing called REST.
Never heard of it.
I know you haven't. So I'm going to model what it looks like to be a leader that steps away and places ambition on the back burner and heal.
All right, best of luck. Kim Fox, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're back with more right after this.
Local organizations are pushing back on the city's plan to merge its migrant shelter operations with its homeless shelter network. The city is set to launch the plan known as the One System Initiative, launching January 1st with a total of 6,800 shelter beds. And the mayor's 2025 budget proposal is set to spend 21% more to fight homelessness than it did this year. But critics claim these efforts are not enough. Here with more on this are Andrea Ortiz, director of organizing at Brighton Park Neighborhood Council, an Action Council co-chair for the Illinois Coalition for Immigration and Refugee Rights, and Andre Vasquez, alderman of the 40th Ward and chair of the Committee on Immigrant and Refugee Rights. We also invited the city to send a representative, but we did not hear back. Thank you both for being here. Andre, I want to start with you. What are your major concerns with the One System Initiative?
Yeah, I think that what we're hearing from folks is like the worry and fear that there's not enough beds. And it's great that we're thinking about like how can we continue to like build these legacy shelters, but at the end of the day, the amount of beds available for folks who have been unhoused in Chicago for a long time and like the new arrivals is not enough. And the fear is that we're going to see more people out in the streets, families that are being dislocated from like where they've already been building those safety networks.
And Alderman Vasquez, just curious, did you have an input on this new initiative?
I definitely have feedback once we got the news. Similarly, our concern was we had gone from 3,000 beds before the migrant mission up to about 15,000 beds for the population and support needed there. Right now there's 8,000. So coming down to 6,800 leaves about 1,200 people without a place to live. And what we've said time and time again is you're increasing homelessness in the city by doing so, and that's going to have a cost to it as well. And so it's been pretty frustrating to watch it develop, even though we had said from the beginning it should have been one system.
Mm-hmm. And Alderman, the city's proposed spending plan for 2025 calls to spend $195.6 million on homelessness services, an increase from the 2024 budget. Are these funds sufficient?
in your opinion?
I think in order to address homelessness, you're going to need more funding. But some of it's also programmatic, right? It's what are we doing to prepare? The city hasn't even prepared for extreme weather conditions during the winter. And we're going to have a lot more people out here who need help. So the funds are somewhat there. Clearly, we have our own financial constraints we're trying to work through. But it's also what we do and how we plan things out that leave a lot of questions.
And what about the limitations? You know, the city plans to open the shelter for first-time placement, but only for people who've been here for 30 days or less. Andrea, you know, what is your main concern with that?
Yeah, we know what works, and we know that if you're investing in people by offering them wraparound services, affordable housing and rent assistance, then we're able to get them into, like, stable living conditions. And we're concerned that they're, like, the alderman said, there's not enough beds, and there's going to be people out in the streets, and thinking about the families and even just like individuals, we really need to stand in our morals and values right now and support the folks that are coming.
And Alderman, we've already seen new arrivals actually be in tents outside. They're in tents themselves. You know, what, in your opinion, do certain groups receive more priority than others? Will they be receiving more priority of their families?
Here's the challenge. The beds are already maxed out. So if you're going from 8,000 to 6,800, it's not like there's any extra capacity. So regardless of whether it's 30 days or they've been here, born and raised in a city, when they go to, you know, submit a 311 request or whatever to get to go through the process, they're going to find out all those beds are full, right? So all of those things, whether we talk about rapid rehousing, right, we're investing money in that. Rehouse them where if the beds are full? And that's the problem that's never been answered. The administration keeps presenting it as they're expanding the system when they're actually limiting it further.
Now, we did have the city deputy mayor of immigrant and refugee rights, Beatrice Bontaleon, on the show last month. She addressed concerns people might have about sheltering new arrivals with long-term unhoused residents. Let's take a listen.
We already have new arrivals in some homeless services shelters, and those shelters have figured out the right balance. But part of the One System initiative and the recommendations that came to us from providers in the working groups is to have additional training to provide, you know, bringing in organizations that know how to work with different populations. And I think that as that work continues, it will build the capacity of our shelter system to do that.
Andrea, what has communication been between your organization and the city?
Yeah, we definitely want to see more communication, and especially before policy is implemented. And I think that as an organization that is working directly with those new arrivals and new neighbors, we're able to better inform the city and have case managers working with folks. It's like, this is what our concerns are and our worries are. And not only like before a policy is implemented, but also like during the implementation process and the evaluation of a policy that is impacting these folks.
And Alderman Vasquez, what recommendations would you include in the One System initiative? You did say you had some input, so what would that look like?
We had feedback. I should say.
What is that feedback at this point?
Yeah, I mean, language access is its own challenge, and we're talking bare fundamentals. The city is not that good at doing language access. Having that needs to make sense. Although there's different organizations they want to like tap into, how do you track somebody who no longer has a place to live? How do you figure out how you get in contact with them again if they do need the services? It's not a thorough process to figure that out. And it gets further complicated in a Trump presidency when we have concerns about what they're going to do. So there's so many things to account for. And it sometimes feels like they're only focusing on the administration is only focusing on the thing that's right in front of them, not the next 2-3 steps forward, which you need to do this properly.
We know homelessness has been an issue for decades. It's no surprise. There's more than 18,000 unhoused residents in Chicago. How are these efforts different from the ones we've seen before?
The only thing that's different is you have 3,800 more beds. But again, not enough for the population that's necessary. Not any preparation for extreme weather. Not any preparation for permanent housing. At least in the 40th Ward, what I did in our office is we actually converted a motel to become non-congregate shelter. So it's shelter with wraparound services, a clinic on site. You need to have that in order for people to have someone on their journey with them to feel more stable and get on the path to permanent housing. So if all you're doing is providing a rooftop and a bunch of cots, you're not going to solve the problem, and we don't have enough of them to even solve what's currently happening.
Deputy Mayor, you know, she did mention this was going to be a hard transition. Could this change the existing migrant and homelessness shelter system?
I think that it's only going to increase the number of unhoused folks. I saw that the alderman, along with 49 other alders, voted no on the property tax increase, and I'm looking forward for the alderman to push forward progressive policies, solutions, and recommendations to help fund the wraparound services and the case management that's going to help all Chicagoans get into stable housing.
And you have been on the ground. What has it been like, especially with now knowing that Donald Trump is a president-elect? You know, what has it been like for the people that you've spoken with at the shelters?
Folks are really scared, and a lot of folks are still waiting for their work permits, and they're like, what's going to happen once we transition? And they have children who are enrolled in CPS schools. They're like, what happens if Trump comes and we don't get the work permits, and then we can't stay in these shelters and can't work? And it's like, what feels really important is, like, we've been here before, and there's also 11 million undocumented folks in the United States. It's like, how do we continue to support the folks who are unable to get those protections and help them integrate into our communities, and also support longtime Chicagoans who also need those supports?
And Alderman, we only have a couple seconds. What are your final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone here feels dire. It is clear. The only thing that brings me any level of solace is that we've gone through 4 years of a Trump presidency before. So some of that muscle memory is still there. But what it's going to take is all of us having real conversations with each other and figuring out how to partner up. And if we don't do that, we're going to be even worse off.
Well, thank you both for joining us. And that's our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:37 and 10 for the weekend review. Now, from all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm committed to giving back to the community through law and philanthropy.